They are sociopaths. Certainly the very worst of the unthinkable deeds we read about in our newspapers and tacitly ascribe to human nature, though the events shock us as normal human beings, are not reflective of normal human nature at all, and we insult and demoralize ourselves when we assume so. Mainstream human nature, though far from perfect, is very much governed by a disciplining sense of interconnectedness, and the genuine horrors we see on television and sometimes endure in our personal lives do not reflect typical humankind. Instead, they are made possible by something quite alien to our nature, the cold and complete absence of conscience. This is, I think, somewhat difficult for many people to accept. We have a hard time acknowledging that particular individuals are shameless by their nature, and the rest of us are not so, due in part to what I refer to as the shadow theory of human nature. Shadow theory, the simple and probably acute notion that we all have a shadow side, not necessarily apparent from our usual behavior, maintains in its most extreme form that anything doable or feelable by one human being is potentially doable or feelable by all. In other words, under certain circumstances, though they are circumstances we are hard-pressed to imagine, anyone at all could be, for example, a death camp commandant. Ironically, good and kind-hearted people are often the most willing to subscribe to this theory in the radical form that proposes they could, in some bizarre situation, be mass murderers. It feels more democratic and less condemnatory, and somehow less alarming, to believe that everyone is a little shady, than to accept that a few human beings live in a permanent and absolute moral nighttime. To admit that some people literally have no conscience is not technically the same as saying that some human beings are evil, but it is disturbingly close. And good people want very much not to believe in the personification of evil. Of course, though not everyone could be a death camp commandant, many, if not most people, are capable of overlooking the horrific activities of such a person, owing to the viscosity of psychological denial, moral exclusion, and blind obedience to authority. Asked about our sense that we are not safe in our own world, Albert Einstein once said, "The world is a dangerous place to live, not because of the people who are evil, but because of the people who don't do anything about it." To do something about shameless people, we must first identify them. So, in our individual lives, how do we recognize the one person out of, more or less, 25, who has no conscience and who is potentially dangerous to our resources and our well-being? Deciding whether or not someone is trustworthy usually requires knowing that person well for a long time, and in the case of identifying a sociopath, much better and longer than one would have allowed had the sociopath been wearing a mark on his forehead at the onset. This harrowing dilemma is simply a part of the human condition. But even given the familiarity requirement, the pressing question remains, how can I tell whom to trust? Or, more to the point, whom not to trust? After listening for almost 25 years to the stories my patients tell me about sociopaths who have invaded and injured their lives, when I am asked, how can I tell whom not to trust? The answer I give usually surprises people. The natural expectation is that I will describe some sinister-sounding detail of behavior or snippet of body language or threatening use of language that is the subtle giveaway. Instead, I take people aback by assuring them that the tip-off is none of these things, for none of these things is reliably present. Rather, the best clue is, of all things, the pity play. The most reliable sign, the most universal behavior of unscrupulous people is not directed, as one might imagine, at our fearfulness. It is, perversely, an appeal to our sympathy. I first learned this when I was still a graduate student in psychology and had the opportunity to interview a court-referred patient the system had already identified as a psychopath. He was not violent, preferring instead to swindle people out of their money with elaborate investment scams. Intrigued by this individual and what could possibly motivate him, I was young enough to think he was a rare sort of person, I asked, "What is important to you in your life? What do you want more than anything else?" I thought he might say, "Getting money," or "Staying out of jail," which were the activities to which he devoted most of his time. Instead, without a moment's hesitation, he replied, Oh, that's easy. What I like better than anything else is when people feel sorry for me. The thing I really want more than anything else out of life is people's pity. I was astonished, and more than a little put off. I think I would have liked him better if he had said staying out of jail, or even getting money. Also, I was mystified. Why would this man, why would anyone, wish to be pitied, let alone wish to be pitied above all other ambitions? I could not imagine. But now, after 25 years of listening to victims, I realize there is an excellent reason for the sociopathic fondness for pity. As obvious as the nose on one's face, and just as difficult to see without the help of a mirror, the explanation is that good people will let pathetic individuals get by with murder, so to speak, and therefore any sociopath wishing to continue with his game, whatever it happens to be, should play repeatedly for none other than pity. More than admiration, more even than fear, pity from good people is carte blanche. When we pity, we are, at least for the moment, defenseless, and like so many of the other essentially positive human characteristics that bind us together in groups, social and professional roles, sexual bonds, regard for the compassionate and the creative, respect for our leaders, our emotional vulnerability when we pity is used against us by those who have no conscience. Most of us would agree that giving special dispensation to someone who is incapable of feeling guilt is a bad idea, but often, when an individual presents himself as pathetic, we do so nonetheless. Pity and sympathy are forces for good when they are reactions to deserving people who have fallen on misfortune. But when these sentiments are wrested out of us by the undeserving, by people whose behavior is consistently antisocial, this is a sure sign that something is wrong, a potentially useful danger signal that we often overlook. Perhaps the most easily recognized example is the battered wife whose sociopathic husband beats her routinely and then sits at the kitchen table, head in his hands, moaning that he cannot control himself and that he is a poor wretch whom she must find it in her heart to forgive. There are countless other examples, a seemingly endless variety, some even more flagrant than the violent spouse, and some almost subliminal. And for those of us who do have conscience, such situations, no matter how brazen, seem to present us emotionally with a kind of embedded figure puzzle in which the background design, the appeal for pity, continually overcomes our perceptions of the more important embedded picture, the antisocial behavior. In long retrospect, sociopathic appeals for pity are preposterous and chilling. Skip implied that he deserved sympathy because he had broken someone's arm. Doreen Littlefield represented herself as a poor, overworked soul who was too sensitive to witness her patient's pain. From prison, a lovely and endearing Barbara Graham explained to reporters that society was preventing her from taking proper care of her children. And as for the likes of the aforementioned death camp official, in the 1945 interrogations that preceded the Nuremberg War Crimes Tribunal, testimony from actual death camp guards included their descriptions of how awful it was to be in charge of the crematoriums on account of the smell. In interviews highlighted by British historian Richard Overy, the guards complained that it was difficult for them to eat their sandwiches at work. Sociopaths have no regard whatsoever for the social contract, but they do know how to use it to their advantage. And all in all, I am sure that if the devil existed, he would want us to feel very sorry for him. When deciding whom to trust, bear in mind that the combination of consistently bad or egregiously inadequate behavior with frequent plays for your pity is as close to a warning mark on a conscienceless person's forehead as you will ever be given. A person whose behavior includes both of these features is not necessarily a mass murderer or even violent at all, but is still probably not someone you should closely befriend, take on as your business partner, ask to take care of your children, or marry. Poor Luke. What about the most precious component of the social contract? What about love? Here is one woman's quiet calamity, a story that will never be on the 6 o'clock news. My patient, Sydney, was not pretty. At 45, she had dirty blonde hair that was turning gray and a round, motherly body that had never been glamorous. but she owned a fine intellect and a long list of academic and professional accomplishments. At a university in her home state of Florida, she had been promoted to an associate professorship in epidemiology before she was 30. She studied the population effects of substances used in indigenous medicines, and before her marriage, she had traveled extensively in Malaysia, South America, and the Caribbean. When she moved from Florida to Massachusetts, she became a consultant to an ethnopharmacology group based in Cambridge, but I liked her most for her gentle demeanor and the thoughtful, introspective approach she took to her life. One of the things I remember best about her was the soft warmth of her speaking voice during the brief 15 therapy sessions we had together. Sydney was divorced from a man named Luke. The divorce had drained her life savings and caused her to go into debt because she had needed to make sure she got custody of her son, Jonathan, who was 8 when I knew Sydney, and only 5 at the time of the divorce. Luke had put up an expensive struggle, not because he loved Jonathan, but because he was enraged with Sydney for making him move out of her house. The house in South Florida had a swimming pool. Luke loved the pool. Luke was living in this shabby little apartment when I met him, Sydney told me. That should have raised a red flag for me right there. A 35-year-old man who'd gone to graduate school at NYU, city planning actually, living in that awful little place. But I ignored it. He said he really liked the big pool his apartment complex had, so when he saw I had my own pool, he got all happy. What can I tell you? My husband married me for my pool. Well, it's not entirely true, but in retrospect, it was definitely part of it. Sydney overlooked Luke's lifestyle and his attraction to hers because she thought she had found something rare, an extremely intelligent, attractive 35-year-old man with no wife and no ex-wives, whose interests seemed similar to hers. And who treated her well. He treated me very well at first, I must say. He took me out. He always brought me flowers. I remember all those birds of paradise in long boxes, all those orange flowers. I had to go out and buy some really tall vases. I don't know. He was soft-spoken and sort of quietly charming. We had great conversations. He was another academic type like me, or so I thought. When I met him, he was working on a planning project through a friend of his at the university. Always dressed up in suits. Actually, that's where I met him, the university. Nice, upstanding place to meet somebody, wouldn't you say? He told me he thought we were a lot alike, and I guess I believed him. As the weeks passed, Sydney learned that since Luke had been 20 or so, he had lived with a succession of women, always in their homes, and that having a place of his own, even an inexpensive one, had been an unusual departure from his preferred situation. But she overlooked this information also, because she was falling in love with Luke, and she thought he was in love with her too, because that was what he told her. "I'm just a frumpy academic. No one had ever been so romantic with me." It was a good time. I should probably confess that. Too bad it had to be so short. Anyway, there I was, this frumpy 35-year-old career type, and all of a sudden I was thinking about a white wedding, the whole nine yards. I'd never done that before. I mean, I always thought it was a silly fairy tale. They tell little girls, not something I'd ever have or want. And there I was, wanting it, planning it even. As for the fact that he'd lived off those other women, do you believe I actually felt sorry for him? I thought he was searching for the right person or something, and they usually just threw him out after a while. Now I understand why, but I certainly didn't then. I thought, how lonely, how sad. He said one of those women was actually killed in a car crash. He cried about it when he told me that. I felt so bad for him. 6 weeks after they met, Luke moved into Sydney's house, and 8 months later they were married, a big church wedding, followed by a formal dinner reception paid for by her family. "Doesn't the bride's family always pay for the wedding?" she asked me wryly. 2 months after the wedding, Sydney discovered she was pregnant. She had always wanted children, but had believed she would never marry. Now her dream of motherhood was coming true, and she was overjoyed. It seemed like such a miracle to me, especially when the baby started to move. I kept saying to myself, there's a brand new person in there, someone who never was before, someone I'm going to love for the rest of my life. It was incredible. Luke was obviously a lot less excited than me, but still he said he wanted the baby too. He said he was just nervous. He thought I was ugly while I was pregnant, but I figured he was just being more honest than most men are about it. Ironic, huh? I was so happy about the baby that I didn't let myself know what I think I already knew, if that makes any sense. I think I realized the marriage wasn't going to work while I was pregnant. The doctor told me the worst risk of miscarriage was over after the first 3 months, and so of course I took this literally, and at the 4th month I went out and bought a crib. I remember it was on the day they delivered it, Luke came home and told me he'd quit his job, just like that. It was as if he knew that now he had me. I was about to have a baby, and so I would definitely take care of things. I would take care of him financially because now I didn't have a choice. He was wrong about that, but I can see why he thought it. He must have thought I'd do just about anything to hold on to that semblance of family. Of course, that was not what Luke said to Sydney, or to her friends or her family. He told them all that he was depressed, far too depressed to work. And whenever others were around, he fell silent, looked hangdog, and in general played the part of a depressed person. To make matters even more confusing for Sydney, a number of people told her that depression among first-time fathers was common. "But I never really thought he was depressed," Sydney told me. "Something didn't seem right. I've been a little depressed myself at times, and this just wasn't it. For one thing, he had way too much energy when there was something he really wanted to do. And also, this seems like a small thing, but it made me pretty nuts. He wouldn't get help. I said we should spend some money for a therapist or maybe some kind of medication, but he avoided that idea like the plague. When Jonathan was born, Sydney took a 2-month maternity leave from her teaching, which meant that all 3 members of the family were at home together, since Luke was not working. But Luke seldom even looked at his new son, preferring to read magazines by the pool or to go out with his friends. And when Jonathan cried, as newborns will, Luke would get angry, sometimes enraged, and demand that Sydney do something about the noise. He acted like a martyr, I think is the best way to put it. He'd hold his ears and make these tormented faces and pace around as if the baby were crying just specifically to create problems for him. I think I was supposed to feel sorry for him or something. It was creepy. I'd had a C-section, and I really could have used some help at first, but I ended up wishing that Jonathan and I could just be alone. The same people who had told Sydney about depressed first-time fathers now assured her that new dads sometimes felt uncomfortable around their newborns and so kept their distance for a while. They insisted that Luke needed sympathy and patience. But Luke wasn't keeping his distance the way they thought. He was totally oblivious. Jonathan might as well have been a bundle of rags, for all he cared, an annoying little bundle of rags. Still, don't you know, I wanted to believe those people. I wanted to believe that somehow, if I could manage enough understanding and patience, everything was going to be okay. We were going to be a real family, eventually. I wanted so much to believe that. When her maternity leave was over, Sydney went back to work and Luke stayed by the pool. Sydney contacted an au pair agency to find daytime childcare because it was clear that Luke was not going to take care of Jonathan. After a few weeks, the young sitter confided in Sydney that she felt weird, keeping the baby with the father always present, but never showing any interest. "I can't understand why he never even looks at his baby. Is he quite all right, ma'am?" the sitter cautiously asked Sydney. Using a variant of the excuse Luke had provided, an embarrassed Sydney told her, "He's going through a hard time in his life right now. You can just kind of pretend he's not there and you'll be fine." Sydney recounted how the sitter looked out through the glass doors of the den toward the swimming pool, presumably seeing a relaxed and tan Luke sitting there in the Florida late afternoon. Cocking her head to one side in curiosity, she said softly, "Poor man." Sydney told me, "I'll always remember that. Poor man. Poor Luke." It was how I felt about him, too, sometimes, despite myself. But the truth was that the person Sydney had married was not poor Luke at all, nor was he a depressed first-time father, nor was he going through a hard time in his life. Rather, he was sociopathic. Luke had no intervening sense of obligation to other people, and his behavior, though not physically violent, reflected this dangerous fact. For Luke, societal rules and interpersonal expectations existed only to serve his advantage. He told Sydney that he loved her and then went so far as to marry her, primarily for the opportunity to ensconce himself as a kept man in her honestly earned and comfortable life. He used his wife's dearest and most private dreams to manipulate her, and their son was an aggravation he moodily tolerated, only because the baby seemed to seal her acceptance of his presence. Otherwise, he ignored his own child. Soon, he began to ignore Sydney as well. It was kind of like having a boarder you don't like very much and who doesn't pay rent. He was just kind of there. For the most part, we lived these parallel lives. There was Jonathan and me, always together, and then there was Luke. I really don't know what he did most of the time. Sometimes he'd leave for a day or two. I don't know where he went. I stopped caring about it. Or sometimes he'd have a friend over for drinks, always unannounced, which could be kind of a problem at times. And he'd rack up big phone bills. But mostly he just sat around by the pool, or when the weather was bad, he'd come in and watch TV or play computer games. You know, those computer games 13-year-old boys play. Oh, and I nearly forgot, for a couple of months he collected lithographs. I don't know what put him onto that, but he was really excited about it for a while. He'd buy a new one. They were expensive, let me tell you. And he'd come bringing it in to show me, like a kid, like nothing was wrong between us, and he wanted me to see the new addition to his art collection. He must have collected about 30 of them, never framed them, and then one day he just dropped the whole business. No more interest in lithographs. Over. Sociopaths sometimes exhibit brief, intense enthusiasms, hobbies, projects, involvements with people that are without commitment or follow-up. These interests appear to begin abruptly and for no reason, and end the same way. I had a new husband and a new baby. It should have been one of the happiest times of my life, and it was one of the worst. I'd come home from work, really tired, and the sitter would let me know that Luke hadn't so much as glanced at Jonathan all day. And after a while, my own husband began to disgust me so much that I couldn't even sleep in the bedroom. I'm ashamed to tell you this, but I slept in my own guest room for a year. Overall, the greatest difficulty Sydney had in telling me her story was her painful embarrassment about what had happened to her life. As she put it, you can't imagine how humiliating it is to admit, even just to admit to yourself, that you actually married somebody like that. And I wasn't a kid when I did it either. I was 35 already, not to mention I had been around the world several times. I should have known better, but I just didn't see it. I didn't see it at all, and to give myself a little break, I don't think anyone else who was around at the time saw it either. These days, everybody tells me they never dreamed he'd end up acting that way. And everyone has a different theory about what's wrong with Luke. If it weren't so embarrassing, it would be funny. Different friends have decided it's everything from schizophrenia to something like attention deficit disorder. Can you imagine? Unsurprisingly, not a single person guessed that Luke simply had no conscience, and that this was why he ignored his obligations to his wife and his child. Luke's pattern did not fit anyone's images of sociopathy, even nonviolent sociopathy, because Luke, though he had a high IQ, was essentially passive. He did not go about cutting throats, either literally or figuratively, in an attempt to achieve power or wealth. He was no corporate shark, and certainly no fast-talking, high-octane skip. He did not have enough vitality even to be an ordinary con man, or enough physical courage to rob banks or post offices. He was not a mover. He was, in effect, a non-mover. His predominant ambition was to be inert, to avoid work, and to have someone else provide a comfortable lifestyle, and he exerted himself just enough to reach this middling goal. And so how did Sydney finally recognize his remorselessness? It was the pity play. Even after that really ugly divorce, he still hung around the house, and I do mean nearly every day. He got another crummy little apartment, and he always slept there, but during the day, he'd hang out at my house. I know now that I shouldn't have let him, but I felt sorry for him, and also he was paying a little more attention to Jonathan. When he'd come home from kindergarten, sometimes Luke would even meet him at the bus, walk him home, give him a little swimming lesson or something. I felt nothing for the man. I really never wanted to see him again, but I wasn't going out with anyone, like I'm going to trust another man, right? And I thought it was a good thing if Jonathan could get to know his father, get a little attention from him. I figured it was worth the nuisance if my child could have at least part of a dad. Well, that was a mistake. My sister was the one who called the shot. She said, Luke doesn't have a relationship with Jonathan. He has a relationship with your house. And oh boy, was she ever right. But then I couldn't get rid of him. Things got really awful and complicated and creepy. It was really creepy. She shuddered, then took a breath and went on. Jonathan was in the first grade, I realized I had to get Luke out of our lives once and for all. There was just no peace, I want to say joy. When someone doesn't care about you at all like that, having him around you so much really sucks out the peace and the joy from your life. He kept just showing up. He'd come in or go out to the pool and make himself comfortable, just like he still lived there. I'd get really morose, really tense. I'd stay in the house with the shades drawn, just so he wouldn't be in my line of sight. It was crazy. Then I realized Jonathan's spirits were going down, too. He didn't really want Luke around either. So I started asking him to leave. Now, if I were over at somebody else's house and they asked me to leave, I'd leave. Wouldn't you? If only for my own dignity. Not Luke. He acted like he hadn't even heard me, which was fairly creepy all by itself, or he'd leave for a while and then he'd come back just like nothing had happened. So I'd get really angry, and instead of just asking him to leave, I'd scream at him to get out, or I'd threaten to call the police. And do you know what he did? He used Jonathan, I said. That's right. How did you know? He used Jonathan. For example, we were out by the pool, all three of us, and Luke started to cry. Actual tears came out of the man's eyes. Then I remember he picked up the net we used to skim the pool and started skimming, like he was a suffering martyr who only wanted to help. And then John got tearful too, and he said, and I'll remember this for the rest of my life, Jonathan said, "Oh no, poor Daddy, do we have to make him leave?" And then Luke looked me right in the eyes, and it was as if I'd never met him before in my life. He looked that different. Those are the creepiest eyes I've ever seen, like beams of ice. It's really hard to explain. And I realized all of a sudden that in Luke's mind, this was all some kind of a control game. It was some kind of a game, and I had lost big time. I was stunned. Within a year after this scene by the pool, Sydney left Florida and her university position there and moved with Jonathan to the Boston area to be closer to her sister and 1,500 miles away from Luke. A few months later, she started a brief therapy with me. She needed to work through some of the issues left over from her marriage, especially her self-blame that she had married Luke in the first place. She was an extremely resilient person. I have every reason to think her life is happier now. She would sometimes joke in the case of her problem with Luke, the famous geographic cure just might work, although she knew that the longer journey of self-forgiveness would be more complicated. Sydney was able to gain a certain understanding of her ex-husband's lack of conscience, and this new perspective was helpful to her. Her greatest remaining concern was the emotional vulnerability of her 8-year-old son, Jonathan. The last time I saw Sydney, she told me that she and Jonathan were still having tearful discussions about Florida and how much he felt sorry for Daddy. Chapter 7. The Etiology of Guiltlessness. What causes sociopathy? Since adolescence, I have wondered why so many people take pleasure in humiliating others. Clearly, the fact that some are sensitive to the suffering of others proves that the destructive urge to hurt is not a universal aspect of human nature. Alice Miller. In many ways, Luke, Doreen, and Skip are very different from one another. Luke favors inertia. He likes to lounge and to let responsible friends and family members take care of everything else. Doreen is envious and a chronic malcontent. She exerts a great deal of energy trying to make other people look smaller so that she can feel bigger. And Skip would like to run the world for his own benefit, of course, and as a grandiose form of entertainment. But what these three diversely motivated human beings have in common is that, in the interest of their individual ambitions, they can do anything at all without the slenderest glimmer of guilt. Each of them desires something different, but they all get what they want in exactly the same fashion, which is to say, completely without shame. Skip breaks the law and ruins careers and lives, and he feels nothing. Doreen makes her whole life into a lie, and torments the helpless for the thrill of making her colleagues look bad, and all without the slightest blip of embarrassment or accountability. For someone to take care of him, a rent-free house, and a swimming pool, Luke lovelessly marries a decent woman who wants to have a family, and then steals some of the joy from his son's childhood in an attempt to retain his own childlike dependency. And he makes such decisions without thinking twice, let alone being assailed by guilt. None of these people has an intervening seventh sense of obligation based in emotional attachments, while sadly, this commonality among them does not make them extremely rare, it does make them profoundly different from all people who do have conscience. All three are members of a group apart, a human category, in which the distinguishing feature, the absence of conscience, cuts across all other personality features, and even gender, in terms of how individuals perceive their surroundings and go about their lives. Doreen is more like Luke and Skip than she is like any woman in the world who has conscience, and laconic Luke and driven Skip are more like each other than any conscience-bound man or woman of any temperament whatsoever. What carves this deep and yet strangely invisible dividing line across the human race? Why do some people not have a conscience? What causes sociopathy? Like so many human characteristics, both physical and psychological, the primary question is that of nature versus nurture. Is the characteristic born in the blood, or is it created by the environment? For most complex psychological features, the answer is very probably both. In other words, a predisposition for the characteristic is present at conception, but the environment regulates how it is expressed. This is true both for traits we consider negative and for those we think of as positive. For example, level of intelligence would appear to be strongly determined by genetic makeup, but partly shaped by an elaborate toolbox of environmental factors as well, such as prenatal care, early stimulation, nutrition, and even birth order. Sociopathic deviance, a decidedly more negative characteristic, is probably no exception to this sum of each paradigm. Research indicates that both nature and nurture are involved. Psychologists have long known that many aspects of personality, such as extroversion and neuroticism, are influenced to some degree by genetic factors. Much of the scientific evidence for this is provided by studies comparing monozygotic, identical, and dizygotic, fraternal, twins. The underlying premise in such research is that identical twins share an environment and all of their genes, whereas fraternal twins share an environment but only about half of their genes. For any given trait, scientists assume that if the correlation or likeness for genetically identical twins is significantly greater than the correlation for genetically dissimilar twins, there is at least some genetic influence for that trait. Researchers use a number that is double the difference between the identical twin correlation and the fraternal twin correlation to indicate the amount of variation thought to be accounted for by genetic factors. This number is referred to as the trait's heritability, and studies on twins have shown that personality features determined by questionnaires, such as extroversion, neuroticism, authoritarianism, empathy, and so forth, have a heritability of between 35% and 50%. In other words, twin studies indicate that most measurable aspects of our personalities are 35 to 50% innate. Heritability studies contain important information about sociopathy. A number of such studies have included the Psychopathic Deviate, PD, scale of the Minnesota Multiphasic Personality Inventory, the MMPI. The PD scale, the MMPI, consists of multiple-choice questions that have been statistically formulated to sort out people with sociopathic personality traits from other groups of people. The inventory includes several validity measures as well, including a lie scale to expose attempts to beat the test. Overall, in these studies, identical twins are twice or more as likely to have similar scores on the PD scale as fraternal twins, strongly suggesting at least some genetic role in the psychopathic deviate pattern. In 1995, a major longitudinal study was published that investigated sociopathic traits and their absence in 3,226 pairs of male twins located through a register of people who had served in the United States Armed Services during the Vietnam War. By the same mathematical model, 8 sociopathic symptoms and their absence were found to be significantly heritable. They are, in descending order of theoretical heritability, fails to conform to social norms, aggressive, reckless, impulsive, fails to honor financial obligations, inconsistent work, never monogamous, and lacks remorse. Still, other studies have found that sociopaths have low agreeableness, low conscientiousness, and low harm avoidance, all of which personality dimensions have a genetic component. The Texas Adoption Project, which has now been in progress for over 30 years, is a highly regarded longitudinal study of more than 500 adopted children. The study looks at the acquisition of intelligence and various personality features, including the psychopathic deviant pattern, by comparing adopted children, now grown, with both their biological and adoptive parents. The Texas Adoption Project reports that, where scores on the PD scale are concerned, individuals resemble their birth mothers, whom they have never met, significantly more than they do the adoptive parents who raised them. From this research, a heritability estimate of 54% can be derived, and interestingly, this psychopathic deviant figure is consistent with the heritability estimates, 35 to 50%, generally found in studies of other, more neutral personality characteristics, extroversion, empathy, and so forth. Over and again, heritability studies come up with a statistical finding that has emotionally charged social and political implications, that indeed a person's tendency to possess certain sociopathic characteristics is partially born in the blood, perhaps as much as 50% so. To bring home the provocative nature of this research, it would indicate, for example, that before they were even born, at the very moment of conception, people such as Doreen, Luke, and Skip were already somewhat predisposed to become deceitful, reckless, faithless, and remorseless. When we make heritability statements about athletic ability or introversion or even bipolar disorders or schizophrenia, somehow the information does not seem so shocking. But to say so about antisocial tendencies feels especially grim, though the same statistical approaches are used. It is important to point out that such extremely complex characteristics are unlikely to be determined by a single gene, but are almost certainly oligogenic, meaning caused by multiple genes acting together. And the exact way in which these genes go about shaping brain function and then behavior is currently unknown. Getting from a person's DNA to a many-layered behavioral concept, such as fails to honor financial obligations, is a long, labyrinthine biochemical, neurological, and psychological trip, and is correspondingly daunting to study. But research has already provided us with a few pointed hints. One important link in the neurobiological behavioral segment of the chain may consist of altered functioning in the cerebral cortex of the sociopath. Some of the most interesting information about cortical functioning and sociopathy comes to us through studies of how human beings process language. As it turns out, even at the level of electrical activity in the brain, normal people react to emotional words such as love, hate, cozy, pain, happy, mother, more rapidly and more intensely than to relatively neutral words, table, chair, 15, later, etc. If I am given the task of deciding between words and non-words, I will recognize terror over Lister much faster, in terms of microseconds, than I will choose between window and endoc. And my enhanced reaction to the emotional word terror can be measured by recording a tiny electrical reaction called an evoked potential in my cerebral cortex. Such studies indicate that the brains of normal people attend to, remember, and recognize words that refer to emotional experiences preferentially to emotion-neutral words. Love will be recognized as a word faster than look will be, and a greater evoked potential will result in the brain, very much as if love were a more primal and meaningful piece of information than look. Not so for sociopathic subjects who have been tested using language processing tasks. In terms of reaction time and evoked potentials in the cortex, sociopathic subjects in these experiments respond to emotionally charged words no differently from neutral words, In sociopaths, the evoked potential for sob or kiss is no larger than the one for sat or list, very much as if emotional words were no more meaningful or deeply coded by their brains than any other words. In related research using single-photon emission-computed tomography, brain imaging technology, sociopathic subjects showed increased blood flow to the temporal lobes relative to other subjects when they were given a decision task that involved emotional words. To enable our concentration, you or I might exhibit such an increased cerebral blood flow if we were asked to solve a mildly challenging intellectual problem. In other words, sociopaths trying to complete an assignment based on emotional words, a task that would be almost neurologically instantaneous for normal people, reacted physiologically more or less as if they had been asked to work out an algebra problem. Taken together, such studies indicate that sociopathy involves an altered processing of emotional stimuli at the level of the cerebral cortex. Why this altered processing occurs is not yet known, but it is likely to be the result of a heritable neurodevelopmental difference that can be either slightly compensated for or made much worse by child-rearing or cultural factors. This neurodevelopmental distinction is at least partially responsible for the still unfathomed psychological difference between sociopaths and all other people, and its implications are startling. Sociopathy is more than just the absence of conscience, which alone would be tragic enough. Sociopathy is the inability to process emotional experience, including love and caring, except when such experience can be calculated as a coldly intellectual task. Just as conscience is not merely the presence of guilt and remorse, but is based in our capacity to experience emotion and the attachments that result from our feelings, sociopathy is not just the absence of guilt and remorse. Sociopathy is an aberration in the ability to have and to appreciate real, non-calculated, emotional experience, and therefore to connect with other people within real, non-calculated relationships. To state the situation concisely, and maybe a little too clearly for comfort, not to have a moral sense flags an even more profound condition, as does the possession of conscience, because conscience never exists without the ability to love, and sociopathy is ultimately based in lovelessness. A sociopath is someone who fails to conform to social norms, or who is never monogamous, or who fails to honor financial obligations, for the straightforward reason that an obligation of any kind is something one feels toward beings or toward a group of beings who matter emotionally, and to a sociopath, we simply do not matter. Sociopathy is, at its very essence, ice cold, like a dispassionate game of chess. In this way, it is different from ordinary duplicitousness, narcissism, and even violence, which are often full of emotional heat. If necessary, most of us would lie to save the life of someone in our family, and it is something of a cliché to point out that a violent gang member, as opposed perhaps to his sociopathic leader, may conceivably feel loyalty and warmth toward the members of his gang, and tenderness for his mother and siblings. But Skip, even as a child, was not concerned with anyone. Dr. Littlefield could not care about her patients, and Luke could not love even his wife or his own child. In the workings of such minds, other people, even friends and family members, are serviceable game pieces at most. Love is not a possibility, or even something that can be comprehended when another person shows it. The only emotions that sociopaths seem to feel genuinely are the so-called primitive affective reactions that result from immediate physical pain and pleasure, or from short-term frustrations and successes. Frustration may engender anger or rage in a sociopath, and predatory success, winning at a game of cat and mouse, for example, Doreen's success in sending Jenna on a fool's errand across the muck of a hospital lawn, typically sparks aggressive affect and arousal, a rush that may be experienced as a moment of glee. These emotional reactions are seldom long-lasting, and they are referred to as neurologically primitive because, like all emotions, they originate in the evolutionally ancient limbic system of the brain. But unlike the higher emotions, they are not significantly modified by the functions of the cerebral cortex. As a counterpoint to sociopathy, the condition of narcissism is particularly interesting and instructive. Narcissism is, in a metaphorical sense, one half of what sociopathy is. Even clinical narcissists are able to feel most emotions as strongly as anyone else does, from guilt and sadness to desperate love and passion. The half that is missing is the crucial ability to understand what other people are feeling. Narcissism is a failure not of conscience, but of empathy, which is the capacity to perceive emotions in others and so react to them appropriately. The poor narcissist cannot see past his own nose, emotionally speaking, and as with the Pillsbury Doughboy, any input from the outside will spring back as if nothing had happened. Unlike sociopaths, narcissists often are in psychological pain and may sometimes seek psychotherapy. When a narcissist looks for help, one of the underlying issues is usually that, unbeknownst to him, he is alienating his relationships on account of his lack of empathy with others and is feeling confused, abandoned, and lonely. He misses the people he loves and is ill-equipped to get them back. Sociopaths, in contrast, do not care about other people and so do not miss them when they are alienated or gone, except as one might regret the absence of a useful appliance that one had somehow lost. For their own reasons, sociopaths sometimes marry, but they never marry for love. They cannot fall genuinely in love, not with their spouses, their children, or even a pet. Clinicians and researchers have remarked that where the higher emotions are concerned, sociopaths can know the words, but not the music. They must learn to appear emotional, as you and I would learn a second language, which is to say, by observation, imitation, and practice. And just as you or I, with practice, might become fluent in another language, so an intelligent sociopath may become convincingly fluent in conversational emotion. In fact, this would seem to be only a mildly challenging intellectual task, quite a lot easier than learning French or Chinese. Any person who can observe human actions, even superficially, or who can read novels and watch old movies, can learn to act romantic, or interested, or soft-hearted. Virtually anyone can learn to say, I love you, or to appear smitten and say the words, oh my, what a cute little puppy. But not all human beings are capable of experiencing the emotion implied by the behavior. Sociopaths never do. Nurture. Still, as we know from the study of so many other human characteristics, genetic predispositions and neurobiological differences do not comprise unavoidable destinies. The genetic marble of our lives predates our birth, but after we are delivered, the world takes up its sculptress's knife and begins to chisel with a vengeance upon whatever material nature has provided. Heritability studies tell us that for sociopathy in particular, biology is half of the story at most. In addition to genetic factors, there are environmental variables that affect the condition of being without conscience, though, as we are about to see, just what these influences are remains somewhat obscure. The speculation about social factors that makes the most immediate intuitive sense is childhood abuse. Perhaps some people with a genetic and neurological predisposition to sociopathy ultimately become sociopathic, while others do not, because the ones who become sociopaths are abused in childhood, and the abuse worsens their psychological status and possibly even their already compromised neurological functioning. After all, we know as a certainty that childhood abuse has a large number of other negative outcomes, among them run-of-the-mill, non-sociopathic, juvenile delinquency and violence, adult depression, suicidality, dissociation, and various divisions of consciousness, anorexia, chronic anxiety, and substance abuse. Psychological and sociological studies show us beyond the shadow of a doubt that childhood abuse is unrelentingly toxic to the psyche. But the problem with attributing sociopathy to early abuse is that, quite unlike non-sociopathic juvenile delinquency and ordinary violent behavior, there is no convincing body of findings linking the core characteristic of sociopathy, that is, the absence of conscience, with childhood maltreatment. Furthermore, sociopaths as a group are not afflicted with the other tragic consequences of childhood abuse, such as depression and anxiety, And we know from a substantial accumulation of research evidence that survivors of early abuse, whether they be law-breaking or not, are predictably plagued by such problems. In fact, there is some evidence that sociopaths are influenced less by their early experience than are non-sociopaths. In Robert Hare's Diagnostic and Statistical Studies of American Prison Inmates, for example, for prisoners who were diagnosed as psychopaths, using the psychopathy checklist developed by Hare, quality of family life in childhood had no effect whatsoever on the timing of criminal behavior. Whether their family life had been stable or not, those diagnosed as psychopaths first appeared in court at an average age of 14. In contrast, for inmates who were not diagnosed as psychopaths, prisoners whose underlying personality structures were more normal, the age at which criminal behavior began was strongly linked with quality of family background. Those with a more stable past first appeared in court at an average age of 24, and those with a troubled background came to court for the first time at about 15. In other words, a hardscrabble existence nurtures and hastens ordinary criminal activity, just as one might expect. But the criminality that results from the remorselessness of sociopathy has the appearance of flowering all by itself, and according to its own timetable. Still searching for environmental influences on the development of sociopathy, many investigators have turned to the concept of attachment disorder, rather than childhood abuse per se. Normal attachment is an innate system in the brain that motivates an infant to seek the nearness of her parent, or whatever caregiver is available, so that the very first interpersonal relationship can be formed. This first relationship is crucial not only for reasons of infant survival, but also because it allows the infant's immature limbic system to use the mature functions of the adult's brain to organize itself. When a parent reacts emphatically to an infant, the child's positive emotions, such as contentment and elation, are encouraged, and her potentially overwhelming negative emotions, such as frustration and fear, can be moderated. This arrangement promotes a sense of order and safety that will eventually be encoded in the baby's own memory, providing her with a portable version of what John Bowlby referred to in Attachment and Loss as a secure base in the world. Research tells us that adequate attachment in infancy has many happy outcomes, including the healthy development of emotional self-regulation, autobiographical memory, and the capacity to reflect upon one's own experiences and actions. Perhaps most important, attachment in infancy allows the individual to create affectionate bonds with other people later on. The earliest attachments are formed by 7 months of age, and most human infants succeed in becoming attached to a first caregiver in a way that develops these important capabilities. Attachment disorder is a tragic condition that occurs when attachment in infancy is disrupted because of parental incompetence, as in a serious emotional disorder on the part of the parent, or because the infant is simply left too much alone, as in an old-fashioned orphanage. Children and adults with severe attachment disorder, for whom attachment was not possible during the first 7 months of life, are unable to bond to others emotionally and are thereby directed to a fate that is arguably worse than death. In the extreme case, as was discovered in the United States in the ultra-hygienic orphanages of the 19th and early 20th centuries, infants who are not touched at all for purposes of antiseptic perfection are prone to die quite literally. Succumbing mysteriously to a condition then referred to as marasmus, a Greek word that means wasting away, a disorder now called non-organic failure to thrive, nearly all of the untouched babies in these orphanages perished. In the intervening 100 years, developmental psychologists and pediatricians have learned that it is crucially important to hold, cuddle, talk to, and caress babies, and that the consequences of not doing so at all are heartbreaking. In Western Europe and in the United States, which ironically is one of the least tactile societies on earth, the grief and loss that attachment disorder can bring was personally experienced by many families during the compassionate rush in the early 1990s to adopt orphaned children from Romania. In 1989, when the communist regime in Romania fell, horrifying photographs were released to the rest of the world of the hundreds of orphanages that had been kept secret by the psychopathic dictator, Nicolae Kosciuszko. Under his regime, Romania was a nation of nearly unsurvivable poverty, and yet Kosico had prohibited both abortion and birth control. Hundreds of thousands of starving children resulted, and nearly 100,000 orphan children ended up in state-run institutions. Overall, in these orphanages, the ratio of orphans to staff was about 40 to 1. Conditions were grotesquely unsanitary, and except for being given enough food to keep most of them alive, the babies and children were ignored. The kindest solution seemed to be for affluent foreigners to adopt as many of these children as possible. Well-meaning Western Europeans and North Americans brought Romanian babies into their homes and lovingly tried to nurse them to health. And then a couple in Paris would discover that their beautiful 10-month-old Romanian daughter was inconsolable and only screamed louder when they tried to hold her. Or a couple in Vancouver would walk into their 3-year-old son's bedroom to find that he had just hurled the new kitten out the window. Or parents in Texas would finally have to admit to themselves that they could not keep their adoptive 5-year-old son from spending his days staring into a corner, and that he sometimes viciously attacked their other children in the middle of the night as they slept. Western Europe and North America had imported an attachment disorder nightmare created by a sadistic Romanian sociopath who was no longer even alive. Having been completely deprived of attachment in infancy, many of these rescued children were loveless. In June 2001, the new leadership of Romania ordered a ban on foreign adoptions, not out of humanitarian concern, but for political and financial reasons. The European Union had just pronounced that impoverished Romania, with its outflow of orphans, had become a marketplace for children, and would be unlikely to achieve membership in the prosperous 15-nation union unless the politically incorrect out-of-country adoptions were terminated. At this writing, more than 40,000 children, a small city's worth, still live in institutions in the Republic of Romania, which is angling for EU membership in 2007. Especially since the exposure of the Romanian orphan crisis, psychologists have wondered whether attachment disorder might be the environmental root of sociopathy. The similarities are obvious. Children who suffer from attachment disorder are impulsive and emotionally cold, and are sometimes dangerously violent toward their parents, siblings, playmates, and pets. They tend to steal, vandalize, and start fires, and they often spend time in detention facilities when they are young and in jail when they become adults, just like sociopaths. And children with severe attachment disorders are the only children who are almost as fundamentally scary to us as young sociopaths are. These similarities have been noticed in many parts of the world. In Scandinavian child psychiatry, for example, a condition called early emotional frustration is thought to be caused by a lack of mutual bonding between mother and child. And in Scandinavia, this diagnostic term, early emotional frustration, is used to flag a child's greater than average chance of developing a sociopathic character disorder by adulthood. Early emotional frustration is statistically linked to factors that may make mother-infant attachment more difficult, such as preterm birth, extremely low birth weight, and maternal substance abuse during pregnancy. There are some minor design problems in this kind of research. For instance, certain factors, such as maternal substance abuse during pregnancy, could easily implicate sociopathic mothers, and therefore return to the genetic explanation. But the major problem with the equation of attachment disorder and sociopathy, despite the scientifically tempting commonalities of the two, is their persistent and undeniable dissimilarity with respect to the trademark features of sociopathy. Quite unlike sociopaths, children and adults afflicted with attachment disorders are seldom charming or interpersonally clever. On the contrary, these unfortunate individuals are typically somewhat off-putting, nor do they make any great efforts to fake being normal. Many are isolates. Their emotional presentation is flat and uninviting, or sometimes directly hostile, and they tend to swing between the distinctly non-seductive extremes of belligerent indifference and unmeetable neediness. None of this allows in any way for the chameleon-like manipulations and con games of the sociopath, with his smiling deceptions and disarming charisma, or for the intermittent success in the material world that the rather sociable sociopath often achieves. Many clinicians and parents have reported that sociopathic children refuse to form warm relationships with family members. They tend to pull away, both emotionally and physically. And of course, so do children with attachment disorders. But very unlike the situation with the sad attachment disorder child, detachment from family is much more likely to be a result of the young sociopath's way of being in the world than it is to be the cause of it. And so, in summary, we have some idea of what one of the underlying neurobiological deficits in sociopathy may be. The sociopaths who have been studied reveal a significant aberration in their ability to process emotional information at the level of the cerebral cortex. And from examining heritability studies, we can speculate that the neurobiological underpinnings of the core personality features of sociopathy are as much as 50% heritable. The remaining causes, the other 50%, are much foggier. Neither childhood maltreatment nor attachment disorder seems to account for the environmental contribution to the loveless, manipulative, and guiltless existence that psychologists call sociopathy. How non-genetic factors affect the development of this profound condition, and they almost certainly do have an effect, is still mainly a puzzle. The question remains, once a child is born with this limiting neurological glitch, what are the environmental factors that determine whether or not he will go on to display the full-fledged symptoms of sociopathy? And at present, we simply do not know. Culture. It is entirely possible that the environmental influences on sociopathy are more reliably linked with broad cultural characteristics than with any particular child-rearing factors. Indeed, relating the occurrence of sociopathy to cultures has so far been more fruitful for researchers than looking for the answer in specific child-rearing variables. Instead of being the product of childhood abuse within the family or of attachment disorder, maybe sociopathy involves some interaction between the innate neurological wiring of individuals and the larger society in which they end up spending their lives. This hypothesis is bound to be disappointing to some people, because though altering the conditions of pregnancy, childbirth, and child treatment on a massive scale would be no small project, changing the values and belief systems of an entire culture is an even more gigantic undertaking, with a time horizon that seems distant and discouraging. We might feel a little less daunted if we were to identify a set of child-rearing practices that we could try to correct in our lifetimes. But perhaps society is the true parent of certain things, and we will eventually find that, as William Ralph Ings said in the early 20th century, the proper time to influence the character of a child is about 100 years before he is born. From recorded observations, we do know that sociopaths, by various names, have existed in all kinds of societies, worldwide and throughout history. As an illustration, psychiatric anthropologist Jane M. Murphy describes the Inuit concept of kunlangeta, which refers to a person whose mind knows what to do, but does not do it. Murphy writes that in northwest Alaska, kunlangeta might be applied to a man who, for example, repeatedly lies and cheats and steals things and does not go hunting, and when the other men are out of the village, takes sexual advantage of many women. The Inuits tacitly assume that kunlangeta is irremediable, and so, according to Murphy, the traditional Inuit approach to such a man was to insist that he go hunting, and then, in the absence of witnesses, push him off the edge of the ice. Though sociopathy seems to be universal and timeless, there is credible evidence that some cultures contain fewer sociopaths than do other cultures. Intriguingly, sociopathy would appear to be relatively rare in certain East Asian countries, notably Japan and China. Studies conducted in both rural and urban areas of Taiwan have found a remarkably low prevalence of antisocial personality disorder, ranging from 0.03% to 0.14%, which is not none, but is impressively less than the Western world's approximate average of 4%, which translates to 1 in 25 people. And disturbingly, the prevalence of sociopathy in the United States seems to be increasing. The 1991 Epidemiologic Catchment Area Study, sponsored by the National Institute of Mental Health, reported that in the 15 years preceding the study, the prevalence of antisocial personality disorder had nearly doubled among the young in America. It would be difficult, closing in on impossible, to explain such a dramatically rapid shift in terms of genetics or neurobiology. Apparently, cultural influences play a very important role in the development, or not, of sociopathy in any given population. Few people would disagree that, from the Wild West of the past to the corporate outlaws of the present, American society seems to allow and even encourage me-first attitudes devoted to the pursuit of domination. Robert Hare writes that he believes our society is moving in the direction of permitting, reinforcing, and in some instances, actually valuing some of the traits listed in the psychopathy checklist, traits such as impulsivity, irresponsibility, lack of remorse. In this opinion, he is joined by theorists who propose that North American culture, which holds individualism as a central value, tends to foster the development of antisocial behavior, and also to disguise it. In other words, in America, the guiltless manipulation of other people blends with social expectations to a much greater degree than it would in China or other more group-centered societies. I believe there is a shinier side of this coin, too. One that begs the question of why certain cultures seem to encourage pro-social behavior. So much against the odds. How is it that some societies have a positive impact on incipient sociopaths, who are born with an inability to process interpersonal emotions in the usual way? I would like to suggest that the overriding belief systems of certain cultures encourage born sociopaths to compensate cognitively for what they are missing emotionally. In contrast with our extreme emphasis on individualism and personal control, certain cultures, many in East Asia, dwell theologically on the interrelatedness of all living things. Interestingly, this value is also the basis of conscience, which is an intervening sense of obligation rooted in a sense of connectedness. If an individual does not, or if neurologically he cannot, experience his connection to others in an emotional way, perhaps a culture that insists on connectedness as a matter of belief can instill a strictly cognitive understanding of interpersonal obligation. An intellectual grasp of one's duties to others is not the same attribute as the powerfully directive emotion we call conscience, but perhaps it is enough to extract pro-social behavior from at least some individuals who would have behaved only in antisocial ways had they been living in a society that emphasized individualism rather than interrelatedness. Though they lack an internal mechanism that tells them they are connected to others, the larger culture insists to them that they are so connected, as opposed to our culture, which informs them resoundingly that their ability to act guiltlessly on their own behalf is the ultimate advantage. This would explain why a Western family by itself cannot redeem a born sociopath. There are too many other voices in the larger society implying that his approach to the world is correct. As a tiny example, had Skip the American been born into a strongly Buddhist culture or Shinto, would he have killed all those frogs? Perhaps, or perhaps not. His brain would have been the same, but all the people around him would have maintained that respect for life was necessary. Everyone in his world would have been of the same mind, including his wealthy parents, his teachers, his playmates, and maybe even the celebrities he saw on television. Skip would still have been Skip. He would have felt no honor for the frogs, no guilt if he murdered them, no repugnance, but he might have refrained from doing so because his culture had unanimously taught him a lesson, something on the order of proper table manners, about how to fit in, a lesson that his perfectly good intellect had mastered. Sociopaths do not care about their social world, but they do want and need to blend in with it. Of course, I'm implying that our own culture would teach a child like Skip that he could torture small animals and still be passably disguised among us. And regretfully, I think this reflects a fair assessment of our current plight. Warriors. Within the context of human society as a whole, across all cultures, is there anything about the lack of caring and the absence of conscience that could be considered positive, or at least useful? As it happens, from a certain point of view, there is one such thing. Whether the victim be a frog or a person, sociopaths can kill without experiencing anguish. Thus, people who have no conscience make excellent, unambivalent warriors, and nearly all societies, Buddhist, Shinto, Christian, or purely capitalist, make war. To some extent, we can think of sociopaths as being shaped and maintained by society because nations so often require cold-blooded killers, from anonymous foot soldiers to the conquerors who have made and continue to make human history. Sociopaths are fearless and superior warriors, snipers, undercover assassins, special operatives, vigilantes, and hand-to-hand specialists, because they experience no horror while killing or while ordering killing, and no guilt after the deed is done. By far most people, the bulk of our armies, cannot be so emotionless, and if they are not carefully conditioned, most normal people make fourth-rate killers at best, even when taking the lives of other people is deemed to be necessary. A person who can look another person in the eye and calmly shoot him dead is unusual, and in war, valuable. Strangely, some acts are so emotionally bankrupt that they require the absence of conscience, just as astrophysics requires intelligence and art requires talent. Of warriors who can operate without conscience, Lieutenant Colonel Dave Grossman writes in On Killing, "Whether called sociopaths, sheepdogs, warriors, or heroes, they are there. They are a distinct minority, and in times of danger, a nation needs them desperately. But these same nations pay a concealed price within their borders for the glory they bestow on their steel-cold killers in the field. The path to such glory does not go unnoticed by others for whom guiltless killing is a special aptitude, others who will never find themselves working behind enemy lines. The self-appointed remain at home, among the rest of us, and mainly invisible. From Rambo to Baghdad, the glorification of killing, the glamorizing of the deepest infraction of normal conscience, has been a lasting feature of our mainstream culture, and may well be the most pernicious environmental influence of all on the vulnerable sociopathic minds in our midst. The owner of such a mind does not necessarily kill, but as we are about to find in the next chapter, when he does, he is not always the person one would have suspected." Chapter 8, The Sociopath Next Door. It may be that we are puppets, puppets controlled by the strings of society, but at least we are puppets with perception, with awareness, and perhaps our awareness is the first step to our liberation. Stanley Milgram. I wanted to talk to someone, and I think it's because my father's in prison. Hannah, the pretty, thin-lipped 22-year-old who was my new patient, directed this barely audible remark to her right, toward one of my bookshelves. After a moment, she looked at me directly, shyly, and repeated herself, "I need someone to talk to. My father's in prison." She made a tiny gasp, as if the effort of this much speech had exhausted her lungs, and then she was silent. Especially when people are very frightened, a certain amount of doing therapy is simply knowing how to paraphrase the comments of the person seated before you without sounding judgmental or patronizing. I bent forward slightly, my fingers laced around my knee, and tried to recapture Hannah's gaze, which had now dropped to the rust-colored oriental rug between our chairs. I said quietly, "Your father's in prison?" "Yes." She looked up slowly when she answered, almost surprised, as if I had gleaned this information telepathically. "He killed a man. I mean, he didn't mean to, but he killed a man. And now he's in prison." "Yes. Yes, he is." She blushed and her eyes filled. I'm always impressed by the fact that even the tiniest amount of being listened to, the barest suggestion of the possibility of kind treatment, can bring such an immediate rush of emotion. I think this is because we are almost never really listened to. In my work as a psychologist, I'm reminded every day of how infrequently we are heard, any of us, or our actions even marginally understood. And one of the ironies of my listening profession is its lesson that in many ways, each of us ultimately remains a mystery to everyone else. "How long has your father been in prison?" I asked. "About 41 days. There was a really long trial. They didn't keep him in prison during the trial." And you felt that you needed to talk to someone?
Yes, I can't.
It's just so depressed. I think I'm getting depressed. I have to start med school.
Med school? You mean in September?
It was July.
Yes, I wish I didn't have to.
The tears came, soundless ones, no weeping noises, as if the rest of her were unaware she was crying. Streams fell from her eyes and rolled down onto her white silk shirt, making translucent stains. Apart from this, her demeanor remained unchanged, stoic. Her face did not fall.
I am always moved by stoicism. Hannah's was extreme. I was hooked.
Using both forefingers, she shoved her straight black hair into submission behind her ears. Her hair was so shiny it looked as if someone had polished it. She gazed past me at the window and asked, "Do you know what it's like for your father to be in prison?"
"No, I don't," I said. "Maybe you'll tell me."
And so Hannah told me her story, or this part of it. Her father had been the principal of the public high school in the middle-class suburb where Hannah was raised, in a different state, 1,000 miles west of Boston. According to Hannah, he was an extremely likable man who naturally drew people to him, a star, as Hannah put it, and was much loved by the students, the teachers, and nearly everyone else in the small community that surrounded the high school. He was always at the cheerleading practices and the football games, and whether or not the home team won was personally important to him. Born and raised in the rural Midwest, he had strong conservative values, Hannah said. He believed in patriotism and a mightily defended country, and also education and self-betterment. Hannah was his only child, and for as long as she could remember, he had told her that even though she was not a boy, she could be whatever she wanted to be. Girls could be whatever they wanted to be. Girls could be doctors. Hannah could be a doctor. Hannah loved her father dearly. "He's the sweetest, most moral man in the world. He really is," she told me. "You should have seen all the people who came to the trial. They just sat there and cried for him, cried and cried. They felt so sorry for him, but there was nothing they could do. You know, nothing they could do." The killing took place on a March night when Hannah, a college sophomore at the time, happened to be home on spring break. In the wee hours, she had been wakened by a very loud noise outside her parents' house.